These voices made headlines this week.
This is a tragic day in the life of our city.
I do not think that we should spend all of our time, though, examining what the government of the United States might be willing to do.
They talk about a five-day week. That's for the birds.
The ABC Radio Network presents Voices in the Headlines, the sounds of the news this week, gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC Radio News.
This is Fred Foy with Voices in the Headlines. The ugly sound of riot, looting, lawlessness, which laid hold of two American cities, New York and Cleveland. The worst by far in Cleveland, where Mayor Ralph Locher said,
"This is a tragic day in the life of our city, and I must say that we will not tolerate policemen and firemen and innocent citizens being the targets for snipers and others, other lawless elements, as they were for a time last night."
Cleveland's Mayor Locher referred to rioting that broke out on Monday night in the Huff section of Cleveland. Gangs of as many as 200 Negroes roamed the area, looting and burning. And in the Monday violence, one Negro woman was killed. It was the beginning of a tragic week for Cleveland. ABC's Don Farmer was there.
I'm standing here at the Pick and Pay supermarket, and this is one of the real targets of this violent movement here in Cleveland's east side. Police now are putting handcuffs on a young Negro boy, perhaps 20 years old. He's now being marched toward a National Guard Jeep, past it now over there to the police car, which is parked right in front of the store, assuming the police are waiting for a van to pick him up and take him to custody.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in Cleveland.
Here comes the fire truck. You can see the blaze is filling the whole store area now, and it looks as though it could shatter the front glass pane windows at any time. Here comes the fire equipment. Fire marshal in front, followed by 1, 2, 3 fire trucks that we can see.
ABC's Don Farmer roamed the Huff area of Cleveland as the riot raged, and as the rioting got worse, city and state officials finally agreed that the National Guard might be able to help control the situation. At Mayor Locher's request, Ohio Governor James Rhodes ordered the troops to Cleveland. Mayor Locher said,
"The Ohio National Guard will be here as long as it is necessary to have it here. The presence of the National Guard has been of immense help in supplementing our police department of the city of Cleveland."
The National Guard moved into Cleveland ready for the worst. Colonel Robert Canterbury said,
"This is a guerrilla war. The advantage of guerrilla war is he knows where he's going to hit next, and we do not."
By week's end, officials in Cleveland found an ominous pattern to the violence and the fires during the riots. Youngsters apparently were being trained in the making of firebombs. Cleveland Police Chief Richard Wagner said a center for the school in rioting was the Jomo Kenyatta House.
"We are aware of the fact that someone has been training juveniles in the manufacture of firebombs. We have, our experience has shown that these forays at previous incidents of several weeks ago emanated from the JFK House."
But Cleveland was not alone. Racial troubles broke out in parts of New York City as groups of youths, Negroes, Puerto Ricans, and whites, battled in the streets and with police. But Negro leader Stokely Carmichael said they weren't riots.
"It's a rebellion against white people who come into the community, who have stores, who exploit these black people and then go home. It is rebellion against landlords who own buildings like those and charge people exorbitant rates and are never here at night but send a man to collect the rent with a gun on his hip. It's not a riot, it is a rebellion."
Trouble in New York was centered in Brooklyn, where William Booth of the New York Human Rights Commission failed in an attempt to control a mob.
"They all ran up toward this command post, which would have been suicidal. They stopped, however, and started coming back. But coming back, they dispersed in various groups and started throwing garbage cans. They started throwing rocks and everything they could find in all directions. And then it was not possible at all to talk with them. I'd lost them by that time.
William Booth is chairman of the New York Human Rights Commission, and he had a warning about the powder keg possibilities in the East New York section of Brooklyn.
I think that there is still a tinder box. This is not at all quieted completely. There's still work to be done. There's considerable work to be done. I'm just thankful that it has not spread.
In Washington, the voice of a chief critic of American policy in Asia, Senator J. William Fulbright.
One wonders whether the Asian doctrine will reap for the United States as rich a harvest of affection and democracy as has the Monroe Doctrine. One wonders whether China will accept American hegemony as gracefully as Cuba and the Dominican Republic have accepted it. And one wonders whether anyone ever thought of asking the Asians if they really want to join the Great Society.
Senator Fulbright, whose outspoken criticisms of the Vietnam War have set the tone for other dissenters, expressed doubts about the overall Johnson policy toward Asia.
The emerging Asian doctrine, about which so much is currently being said and written, represents a radical departure in American foreign policy in that it is virtually unlimited in what it purports to accomplish and unilateral in its execution.
Senator Fulbright was not alone in the Senate this week in examining China policy. Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts advocated a two-China policy, including an offer of a UN seat to the Red Chinese. Senator Kennedy told ABC why he thinks that way.
We would, in effect, be placing the burden of China's absence on the Chinese themselves, should China object to our attempts or subsequently refuse the invitation of the member states. Secondly, we would be shifting the emphasis of the annual discussion from the question of why China should be included or excluded to the question of the preservation of Formosa. Finally, we would be informing the United Nations that we are prepared to labor for the goal of the United Nations being a universal body with representation for all the people of the world.
But Senator Kennedy and others were given an answer by Secretary of State Dean Rusk, who also had a question for them.
Those who might be looking for a way to improve our relations with mainland China must answer that question first. Are you or are you not prepared to surrender Formosa? If you are, then perhaps you can have some, we can have some conversations with Peking. But if you're not, you're not in business with Peking. And we have not felt that we can make that kind of surrender.
Vietnam was still the center of American efforts in Asia as the war in the air and on the ground continued, with air raids over North Vietnam and a big marine battle near the border with South Vietnam. On the point of Americans fighting a ground war in Asia, former Vice President Richard Nixon, speaking at a party fundraising dinner in Chicago, had this to say.
We have said it is not in the interest of the United States to commit our men to fight in a ground war in Asia, and therefore we should make more use of our air and sea power. We have been right. The president recently has taken a belated step to use more of our air power. It was taken too late.
But the war in Vietnam was dominated by Operation Hastings, a ground action involving 8,000 Marines battling North Vietnamese regulars close to the border between North and South Vietnam. In Operation Hastings, the Marines have accounted for more than 600 known communist dead, though the total may be much higher. ABC's Dave Snell is covering Hastings, too, and talked with a Marine sergeant about the communist enemy.
They came out as more like suicide groups more than anything else. Seemed like nothing was going to stop them there. They just kept coming and coming. They seemed to be well-disciplined troops.
And another Marine told about what it's like on the killing ground.
When you see your buddies go down, and it's caused by these people, you want to fight back and you feel that you have to do this. It may be wrong, but it's something you have to do. You have to stop this before your buddies are hurt.
While Marines battled communists in the Hastings operation, there was still talk of peace and other things. Secretary of State Dean Rusk on de-escalation.
Many have tested, have probed the possibilities of de-escalation. It would not be for me to go into detail as to where and when, But the steady, unswerving, uncompromising answer from the other side is that they will make no commitments of any sort, will not seriously discuss the question of what they would do if we began to de-escalate by such things as stopping the bombing.
Among other things being talked about, the threat by the communists to try captured American flyers as war criminals. ABC's Bill Downs asked former President Eisenhower about that.
There's a threat of our flyers being tried by the North Vietnamese. What are your feelings on that?
Of course, I'd be outraged if this would happen. But just exactly what has to be done, I am not in position to give any specific advice. All of us know the president, by the Constitution, has to carry on our foreign relations. If I were there, I think there'd be something pretty strong done, because I just couldn't take that.
Lyndon Johnson indicated he wouldn't take it either.
We think that the thought that these American boys have committed war crimes is deplorable and repulsive, and your government has taken every step that it considers appropriate to see that proper representations on this subject have been made.
And the president told his critics to stop being so one-sided.
I do not think that we should spend all of our time, though, examining what the government of the United States might be willing to do without any regard to what the enemy might be willing to do. We have stated again and again our desire to engage in unconditional discussions, and I repeat them again today. But we can't talk about just half the war. We should talk about all the war.
The nation's capital concerned itself with a variety of matters this week: crime and punishment, Senate ethics, and the airline strike. The Senate Judiciary Subcommittee heard about crime and punishment from Alvin Dewey, a special agent for the Kansas Bureau of Investigation. Dewey said,
"Because of the influence of the rulings of the Supreme Court, the law enforcement officer is looked upon as the bad guy and the criminal as a good guy. Yes, the scales of justice have certainly become overbalanced with the so-called rights of the criminal."
Alvin Dewey of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation said the Supreme Court's decisions on the taking of confessions would have a bad effect on crime fighting. And an author of a book about a sensational murder testified along the same lines. Truman Capote said,
"I would pose a single question. While many in our society today are wailing about the rights of the criminal suspect, why do they seem so totally to ignore the rights of the victims and potential victims?"
While the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee talked of crimes, the Senate Ethics Committee was continuing an investigation of charges of wrongdoing against Senator Thomas Dodd of Connecticut. Dodd has been charged with doing the bidding of lobbyist Julius Klein. Klein testified this week and then told ABC what he testified about.
I wanted to bring out there was nothing unusual in the relationship between Senator Dodd and myself. And our relationship was perfectly proper in every respect. And I hope I have done a good job, especially for Senator Dodd, who was maligned throughout the country as a result of the stolen documents.
Crime, ethics, and the airline strike, all grist for the Senate mills. Senator Wayne Morse, who heads the federal government's special commission on the airline strike, came up with a proposal for special legislation to end the strike.
Joint resolution requires the president, if he finds that this dispute imperils the health, safety, and defense of the nation, that he will authorize the attorney general to make application in the federal district court in the District of Columbia to enjoin the strike and place the five airlines under a federal receivership. If the court finds the health, safety, and defense of the nation is imperiled, such relief will be granted by the court.
Another American success in space by the name of Gemini 10. Astronauts John Young and Michael Collins sent into orbit on Monday for 3 days of action-packed flying, experimenting and practicing on the long road to the moon. Gemini 10 started out as smooth as clockwork, as flight director Gene Lunny pointed out.
One is the countdown that went very smoothly on all fronts. The second thing is the performance of the both launch vehicles, the Atlas Agena and the Gemini launch vehicle, both of them extremely nominal. Spacecraft systems are all working very well at this time. All in all, we've accomplished quite a bit of what we'd planned to do this first day.
But the next 2 days wouldn't go as smoothly. In docking and rendezvousing with an Agena target, Gemini 10 used too much fuel and had to scrap some experiments. Then word of another problem, watery eyes and a bad smell. This was the talk between Gemini 10 and the ground.
Roger, odor. Also, did you notice any sort of throat irritation or experience any coughing?
Nope, no coughing.
Roger, we're trying to pin the possible source of these irritations down, and I think those two, as to definite odor and irritation, are two of our best clues right now.
That bad air problem cleared up when the astronauts stopped using their separate breathing units and went back to breathing capsule air. But all in all, Gemini 10 was a big success, especially in rendezvous and docking, first with Gemini 10's own target Agena, and then with Agena 8 up there since March. The astronauts were quiet most of the time and had to be asked about the Agena 8 rendezvous.
We'd like to have some information on the your rendezvous with 8. How close do you figure you maneuvered your spacecraft to the 8 Agena?
Oh, a couple inches.
A couple inches, Roger, I understand.
That fuel shortage, which limited maneuvering, finally forced Gemini 10 to shorten a spacewalk by Collins.
Tell him to use no more fuel.
Roger. 10 away.
10, go ahead.
Okay, we don't want you to use any more fuel. No more fuel, over.
Well, then he better get back in. Get back in.
Okay, get back in.
Come on back in the house, please.
Okay.
Then on Wednesday, re-entry.
We can see it coming down very, very clearly. The orange and white chute. Brilliant. The spacecraft swinging gently beneath it.
And the astronauts back on Earth aboard the carrier Guadalcanal. John Young.
It was a pretty good mission, we think. We think we accomplished a lot for the space program. And maybe a lot for the country, too. I couldn't have been prouder to have worked with Mike Collins, who I consider one of the finest and most professional men in the country.
And the other not very talkative astronaut, Mike Collins.
I certainly want to thank all of you who made this recovery possible. I know you put in a lot of hard work in your training, just as we have in ours.
And then a happy Dr. George Miller of NASA.
Gemini 10 mission has been successfully concluded. There were many things to be accomplished, but it was an auspicious beginning. I must say that, in my view, it was an auspicious ending as well.
Gemini 10, 3 days in orbit, but a busy 3 days of work. But as members of Congress know, a 3-day work week can be a hard go. Congress allegedly works only Tuesday through Thursday, and someone suggested this week that they should work Monday through Friday, a suggestion that Senator Everett Dirksen hooted down. Senators are very busy, Dirksen said. And they are. Talking, debating, making laws, talking, sitting on committees, talking, legislating, talking, running for office, talking, and...
Then a briefcase full goes home. And you do more work before you go to bed, and you get up with the chickens in the morning, the feathered variety. and start all over again, and then work in the car coming in. They talk about a 5-day week. That's for the birds.
So went this world this week, and the voices in the headlines. Voices in the headlines, a presentation of ABC Radio News. Written and produced by H. Paul Jeffers, directed by Bill Gately. Executive producer, Tom O'Brien. Audio engineering by Bob Foxworth, Pete Sarantopoulos, and Jack McCarthy. Your narrator, Fred Foy. This is Glenn Riggs inviting you to keep up with the news every hour of every day on this ABC radio news station and to catch up with the news each week on Voices in the Headlines.